next cooperative group leader I met with was Dr. Joyce O'Shaughnessy from U.S. Oncology. We began our conversation in a different direction, responding to my query about what she'd like to see happen if there was a quantum leap in available funding for clinical research.
One thing that I would like to see, again, with unlimited resources and unlimited ability for collaborations and regulatory green lights, would be kind of a what I call a Manhattan Project to understand the molecular circuitry of these cancers. I think that there's a lot of good hypotheses out there that cancers, for example, will have one major pathway gone in their DNA repair mechanisms. They'll have a transcription factor that's amplified or translocated and constitutively active, and they'll have one pathway involved that does not allow apoptosis, you know, such as a PI3 kinase mutation or EGFR mutation. And there may only be three or four pathways in some of these key must-have pathways for each cancer. And of course, even in breast cancer, there'll be, from the Chinese menu, if you will, there'll be different options, you know, for which of your DNA repair enzymes is gone, you know, which of your transcription factors is up, which of your proapoptotic pathways is activated, et cetera. And, you know, and there may be also, for example, the communication with the microenvironment, you know, something that activates EMT, for example. But that's just a very sketchy framework there. But you get my point that I think there's going to be three or four pathways that are going to be present in every person's cancer. And there'll be lots of similarities across even cancers. There'll be subtypes. And I think that to really make a lot of progress, we're going to have to understand those pathways and inhibit not just one pathway, but two, three. You know, HIV, it took three drugs, right, to get to that chronic control of the disease. So it may take three. So that's going to be a real pooling of the information in the minds of the people around the world who are deciphering that molecular circuitry. It will take a big institute that perhaps will, and different ways to organize it, that's not your question about the details, but we need a big collaborative effort to be able to have pharmaceutical companies put their agents together with other IND drugs from other companies to be able to do preclinical modeling and to do the phase one and two work. And then the FDA would really need, you know, to think through how to expedite these cocktails, if you will, rather than have to prove the value of each of the agents individually. And in terms of surrogates, and I was reading in the JNCI and I had heard Joseph Ragaz give this interesting talk at San Antonio last year, and then I was reading about it again to refresh my memory just yesterday in the JNCI. I actually agree with Joseph's basic premise, you know, and I think the Herceptin story told us that when we have things in the metastatic setting that really improve survival, I think that personally, I'd like to see accelerated approvals for high-risk populations, for example, our node-positive populations. And I think increasingly our therapies in the metastatic that improve survival will be increasingly targeted to subsets of patients. I'd like to see an accelerated approval for the patients while more definitive studies are being done, while some prospective trials are being done in the high-risk populations, you know, to see if you can see the impact rather than do it like we did with Herceptin, which is we had to wait between the 98 and the 2005, you know, presentations. So I agree with Joseph Ragaz. I like that concept, and I've thought about that during the time of the Herceptin, that survival advantage, which was huge, was good enough for me for the high-risk populations in the adjuvant setting. The other thing that I think is very important is the whole vaccine approach. I think that though I mentioned the molecular circuitry and inhibiting key pathways a la an HIV model, two or three of the big pathways chronically, I think there's a lot of promise in vaccine strategies. And if I were, you know, in charge, I would like to see a much larger effort in vaccine strategies. And once safety was proven in the metastatic setting, really moving them up quickly into the high-risk adjuvant population. Because I think that's going to be very, very important ultimately for really potentially curing or at least long-term control of micrometastatic disease.
What are the trials that are being done in breast cancer by U.S. Oncology?
Well, from an adjuvant standpoint, we are conducting the so-called TIC-TAC trial, which is six cycles of TC, docetaxel or taxotere cytoxan, versus six cycles of TAC. And that's obviously asking the need for Adriamycin question. That's in the HER2 negative population. and that's open to node positive and higher risk node negative patients. We're going to be amending that with the help of the NSABP. The NSABP is taking the lead in working with sponsors to get support to amend the trial to add a third arm, which is TC times 6 with Avastin, to make it a three-arm trial. And the NSABP is going to modify the protocol and then join the study to make it that TC versus TAC versus TC Avastin. The Sarah Cannon's already joined the trial. The Tory Network, Dennis Lehman's Tory Network, has already joined the trial. So we've got three networks on the trial right now. And then when the NSABP joins, that's really a big network. And so that'll be four of us, and it'll go to a 6,000-patient trial or something in that neighborhood. So that's a trial that is ongoing in the adjuvant setting. Of course, we've been party, Neil, to a bunch of other studies that were not predominantly our study, our driven studies, such as the TEACH trial with adjuvant lapatinib or ticurb versus placebo for 1 year in patients who are HER2 positive who did not receive Herceptin, and the TEAM trial, which will report of aromatase versus tamoxifen upfront, which will report next year, and the FACE trial looking at Femara versus Arimidex. And we're going to join the BETH trial with the TCH plus minus Avastin in the adjuvant setting. And then in the neoadjuvant setting, Dr. Frankie Holmes is the PI on a preoperative study of AC followed by weekly Taxol with Herceptin. And this is HER2-positive disease with Herceptin with the Taxol versus lapatinib with the Taxol, or the combination of Herceptin and lapatinib with the Taxol. Interestingly, this trial has a required 2-week run-in of single-agent Herceptin versus lapatinib versus the combination with a biopsy before starting and right after the 2 weeks. And Dr. Jenny Chang is going to be enumerating the number of stem cells in the breast cancer with that intervention, and then also again after the chemotherapy with the lapatinib versus Herceptin versus the combination. The primary endpoint is pathologic complete response rate.
And of course, Jenny Chang has done some really fascinating, I guess, phase 2 studies of neoadjuvant trastuzumab alone and lapatinib alone, and in both of those saw some, I thought, was pretty impressive responses.
Yes, yes, very impressive. The lapatinib in her inflammatory breast cancer model looks incredibly active from a clinical standpoint, just remarkable. And then her observation of the stem cells that she looks at with the CD44 and the CD24, really lowering, the numbers go up with chemotherapy. You know, you're killing off the progeny of the stem cells that are more rapidly dividing, but the stem cell numbers go up with the chemotherapy. But then when you put in lapatinib, either by itself or with the chemotherapy, the numbers go down after lapatinib. Very, very interesting, suggesting that these stem cells in the HER2-positive patient may really be somewhat HER2-driven, and that by blocking the stem cells with the lapatinib, that you really can decrease the number. So we'd like to take a look at that compared to Herceptin and then compared to the combination, of course. So that's very, very nice hypothesis.
What do we know about lapatinib with chemotherapy and specifically Taxol in terms of toxicity?
The one study, Neil, that has been really publicly presented was the large study of first line every 3-weekly Taxol plus minus lapatinib showed that we had to be very careful with regard to the combination of diarrhea from the lapatinib and the myelosuppression from Taxol. You have to be very careful. There were a couple of septic deaths, as I recall. However, once the investigators were aware of that and were able to educate their patients to stop the lapatinib at the first sign of diarrhea and call, interestingly, there were no more septic deaths, which is great. But I think with the weekly Taxol and lapatinib, you know, you get away from a lot of that myelosuppression concern. And so it's much better tolerated with the weekly Taxol and the lapatinib from the overall safety profile. There were data at ASCO from the Dana-Farber. They were looking at weekly Taxol, lapatinib, and Herceptin, you know, in a pilot study in the adjuvant setting. And they did have a 20% of patients, I believe was the number, as I recall, that stopped the lapatinib because of toxicity. And so I think that there's some need there, probably going to be some need for some flexible dose reductions and such. I wasn't involved in that directly, Neil, and we have not had those kind of problems, actually. Now, we've only got like a dozen patients on our study so far, so it's very early, and of course, they're being randomized to one of three arms. But so far, we have not had safety concerns expressed with the Taxol lapatinib or the Taxol Herceptin lapatinib. So, but I think we're going to have to be kind of quick on our feet with regard to dose reductions and education of patients to hold the medication for diarrhea and dose reduce and such.
Now, the whole issue of combining two anti-HER2 agents, specifically lapatinib and trastuzumab, obviously is out on the table in the large international adjuvant trial, ALTO, where some of those patients are going to get the combination. And you just reported at the ASCO meeting a study looking at this combination. Can you talk about what that study looked at?
Sure. This was a study, I think, that we want to remember as an extremely heavily pretreated group of patients who had had an average of 3 prior Herceptin-based regimen for metastatic disease. They had had a median of 4 to 5 prior chemotherapy regimens for metastatic disease. 25% of the patients had had 10 or more treatments for their metastatic breast cancer. So hugely heavily pretreated, I guess, in terms of study populations, actually, just parenthetically, I think this is the most heavily pretreated study I've ever been involved with. And the patients were required to have already progressed through an anthracycline and a taxane and at least one Herceptin-based regimen, and they must have been progressing on Herceptin at study entry. They were randomized to lapatinib alone at 1,500 milligrams daily or a lower dose of lapatinib, the 1,000 daily, with Herceptin every week. So keep the Herceptin going in spite of the fact that they were just progressing through it and were very heavily pretreated with Herceptin. And interestingly, the primary endpoint was progression-free survival, and the median went from 8 weeks median with lapatinib to 12 weeks with the combination. That was statistically significant with a hazard of 0.75, which was significant. But clinically, we would say, well, gee, 4 weeks, is that really impressive? But if you look at percentage of patients progression-free at 6 months, which I think is more important to us clinically, it went from 13% with lapatinib alone to 28% with the combination, so a doubling of the 6-month progression-free survival rates. The survival was almost significant if you adjust it for the stratification factors that were important in the multivariate analysis. There was a 0.055 or something, almost significant p-value in terms of improving survival with the combined blockade, blocking the HER2 from both the outside with Herceptin and the inside with the lapatinib, double blockade of this really important pathway. So I think it was a very important message for us, you know, this far into HER2 treatment, that double blockade, keeping that Herceptin going and coming in with the lapatinib was a better strategy for patients. It was very well tolerated, as you would imagine. Very little in the way. A few patients had some decreases in the LVEF, but then they recovered, et cetera. So really 2 patients or so were symptomatic. Very, very little. It was about a 300-patient trial. So I think the implications of it are that, one, that Herceptin and Ticurb is a reasonable non-chemotherapy-type option for metastatic patients who have disease that is indolent enough, asymptomatic enough that they could take a chemotherapy holiday. That's one implication. Number two, this whole strategy of double blockade of the HER2 pathway is one definitely worthy of pursuit in additional clinical trials, a la ALTO, and frontline trials and preoperative trials, et cetera, as is being done. So this whole idea of double blockade of this all-important pathway, I think, is kind of really confirmed by this trial.
I was kind of surprised that the dose of lapatinib was decreased in the combination arm. What had been seen that caused that to be done?
The reason, Neil, was that when you give the lapatinib with the Herceptin, you actually get more in the way of toxicities, lapatinib-related toxicities, such as the diarrhea.
That's what I heard, but I mean, and I actually heard that supposedly trastuzumab causes diarrhea too. Why would trastuzumab make the diarrhea worse?
I think occasionally it's kind of unusual, but I have had a few patients that have talked about arthralgias and diarrhea on Herceptin, although I think we'd say that that's kind of unusual. I'm not sure why that would be, Neil, to be honest with you.
Can you talk a little bit about how right now you're utilizing lapatinib in a non-protocol situation and what clinical situations, if any, you might consider this combination off protocol?
The lapatinib and capecitabine is a very important combination, particularly for our patients who either have brain metastases or who are at high risk for brain metastases. There were data at ASCO that corroborated the Dana-Farber, Nancy Lynn, Eric Weiner data from San Antonio, and this was from the extended access protocol that after the lapatinib and capecitabine data came out just before FDA approval, it was made available. And it was very interesting. There were about 18% objective responses in patients who had definitive progressing brain metastases at the time of study entry.
You're saying responses in the brain mets?
In the brain mets. Very impressive. I mean, gosh, brain mets is the scourge. I mean, we have so little outside of radiation therapy that we can do for those patients. So I am very bullish on the capecitabine-lapatinib combination as our most promising strategy to help patients with brain metastases. So in the metastatic setting, I really do like to get that treatment in earlier on in metastatic treatment. I must say that if patients have already had adjuvant Herceptin, I do like to go to navalbine and Herceptin first-line metastatic when they recur, you know, provided they have had at least a year disease-free interval after stopping their adjuvant Herceptin. I do like the navalbine-Herceptin combination, both with regard to efficacy and also quality of life. But then I do go on to the capecitabine-lapatinib therapy as my next line of therapy. This new opportunity or option of the lapatinib-Herceptin is one that I could easily see, you know, if patients got toxicity with lapatinib and capecitabine, I might stop it after a while and go on to the combination of lapatinib, Herceptin. Certainly, it's something that I might come back to later down the road. I mean, I think I'm going to give priority to the capecitabine, lapatinib treatment myself, but I might later on come back to double blockade down the road, given the results from the study I presented where patients were so heavily pretreated that, you know, trying that double blockade strategy further down the road seems to me to be quite reasonable, even if somebody already had the Xeloda and lapatinib combination. So I think the lapatinib capecitabine ability to cause objective responses in frank brain metastasis is very promising.
Now, have you actually seen that in your practice, a patient respond with a brain met?
Yeah, I have seen minor responses, Neil, but even more impressive, I've seen very prolonged stable disease. For example, patients who have had whole brain radiation and then have had some stereotactic radiosurgery or some resection, and a lot of times they'll come back with some recurrence, you know, right at the edge of the resection cavity or the SRS field, and they've got disease again. And I've gotten some very, very prolonged disease control, you know, well over a year. I've got a couple of patients, you know, still doing well, you know, pushing 2 years. And so, yeah, I've seen some very, very impressive control of disease.
I sometimes like to ask people about, you know, individual case or patient experiences they have, because I think it's tough sometimes for oncologists to look at data sets and try to get a feel for what it really means. Was there any patient that you treated as part of the lapatinib trastuzumab study that you could maybe discuss as maybe as an example of a situation where the patient really had significant benefit?
One patient that I had on that study was an older woman, 70 years old, and she had very, very extensive liver metastases when she entered on trial. She was quite symptomatic, and she had a dramatic response. What was interesting about that response, as I recall, was the rapidity of that response. She had a very significant, like 50% reduction in her liver metastases, you know, within at the first staging evaluation.
What had she been treated with recently?
Immediately before that, I can't quite recall, Neil, but I can tell you she had had all of our major treatments at that point. She had had the Herceptin and taxane and Herceptin and vinorelbine, and she had had Xeloda. So she had had our major effective therapies for HER2-positive disease.
So she had progressed through trastuzumab and now had symptomatic liver mets?
Yes, she had had multiple Herceptin previous regimens, and she had quite symptomatic liver metastases. And she had a very dramatic response very quickly to the—
How long did it last?
It didn't last that long. It lasted only about 4 months in her particular case. She was very heavily pretreated, but I remember being kind of taken aback at the extent and rapidity of the reduction. But in her case, it was not as long as, you know, didn't quite make that six-month mark, but she got about 4 months out of it.
Are there any clinical situations where you would use any type of chemotherapy with the combination of trastuzumab and lapatinib off study?
We don't have definitive data yet, Neil. I suppose it's possible that I would consider it for a patient with very aggressive disease where I wanted to use the zolotolipatinib combination, I suppose it's possible that I would consider and discuss it with the patient, keeping Herceptin going. We don't have any data for that triplet, so I'm not sure it's something I would do very often, but I suppose I would consider it for the patient who had very symptomatic kind of potentially life-threatening disease. I might consider it, but as a general rule, I probably will wait for some data on that.
We had a patient presented as part of the series that had kind of interesting treatment. It's actually a patient at Chuck Vogel's who actually was on the pivotal trastuzumab trial. So she's been on trastuzumab, trastuzumab hormones, trastuzumab chemo since like 1996. And he actually right now has her on capecitabine, lapatinib, and trastuzumab. Obviously, it's a very unusual situation. But that was a combination that kind of seemed like interesting, but I don't know if anybody even looked at it.
Yeah, I agree with you, Neil. I think that is the combination people probably will be most interested in clinically, you know, extrapolating from the data I presented from ASCO and Chuck Geyer's data. I mean, it's the obvious triplet to consider. And I think a lot of us would be comfortable just even getting, let's get a safety experience with the triplet. And because I think it makes a lot of sense, I am not sure, Neil, whether there's any such trial ongoing at this time or planned, but it would be very nice to see a phase two experience with the triplet.
I guess, you know, you see these patients like this one that seem to have repeated prolonged responses to trastuzumab, and the idea of maybe not stopping it when you're starting the capecitabine lapatinib, I can understand the thought behind it, but as you say, there's really no safety data.
Well, and I think particularly with Chuck Vogel's patient, when somebody has done that well for 12 years with Herceptin, I'm sure it's mighty difficult to consider a hiatus,
right.
You know, and so, and those patients, though 12 years is probably, you know, kind of pushing the record there. We all have patients in our practice that have been out 5, 6, 7, 8 years, you know, and I think that's probably a very good point that that's the patients that we probably are going to be most likely to think about that strategy.
I want to go back to the tic-tac trial. My understanding is now it's going to be called the tic-tac-toe trial.
Yeah.
Although I can't figure out what's the toe stand for.
I know. The Norm Wallmark, he really likes that tic-tac-toe.
I know, right? But the bottom line is it's TC bevacizumab. And, of course, we're seeing adjuvant trials with bevacizumab. There's a colon one. We're waiting on results. There's a lung one that's been launched. There's a couple of breast ones out there. But I think they're mainly been anthracyclines. What was the thinking that went into looking at bevacizumab in this situation with a non-anthracycline TC?
We're all hopeful, I think, that there will be the HER2-negative population that won't need an anthracycline. And I think there's a lot of physicians who are getting behind that hypothesis, Neil. You know, we've got the U.S. Oncology Network, the Sarah Cannon, and the TORI right now, and then the NSABP was extremely interested in that hypothesis. So I think people would not be really joining that trial and supporting it if they didn't feel that there was a decent chance that the HER2-positive patients will not benefit from an anthracycline more than they will from TC. So if that's the case, obviously, then you really do want to ask the Avastin question with a non-anthracycline regimen, you know, similar parallel to the Beth trial, TCH plus minus Avastin. So I think if that is a direction that we may well be heading, then I think it's obviously important to ask that question with bevacizumab's contribution to a non-anthracycline regimen. You know, having said what I said about there's a lot of hope that the HER2 negative will not need the anthracycline, I want to kind of give a little cautionary note that I don't think we're ready to drop the anthracycline without a prospective trial. You know, first of all, we have just decades of efficacy data with the anthracycline. And though the data are there to set up the hypothesis that you don't need it in HER2 positive, we want to remember that in very rapidly growing cancers that have a high proliferative fraction, you're going to have a lot of topo II protein because it's necessary to unwind the DNA and replicate. And there are retrospective analyses on the MA5 CEF versus CMF trial that showed that in patients with a high level of topo II protein, that the CEF was superior to the CMF. Now, that's not a taxane-based regimen, and that's just a retrospective analysis, and there can be all kinds of confounders in those type of analyses. So we're collecting the blocks on the trial. We'll look at HER2 just to be sure they're all negative, and we'll be looking at topo II amplification. We'll be looking at topo II protein expression and Ki-67 just to make sure that leaving the anthracycline off of all of the relevant subsets is a safe thing to do. So I remind myself in my own practice that though I love the TC regimen, when it comes to a node-positive patient, that the three-drug regimen of TAC or docetaxel or FEC followed by Taxotere, one of these proven three- or four-drug regimens is, I believe, still the standard of care.
So, how about node-negative?
Node-negative, I think that we saw from ASCO this year from the GICAM, Miguel Martin, again, TAC versus FAC in the node-negative population, again, with a large disease-free survival advantage and a real good trend there towards survival with 5 years median follow-up. So I think, Neil, that in patients with node-negative disease who are going to benefit from chemotherapy, i.e. ER-negative disease or more highly proliferative ER-positive disease, we want to give them good chemotherapy. And I think that, you know, at MD Anderson, for example, all patients who receive adjuvant chemotherapy receive 12 weeks of weekly Taxol followed by 4 of FAC. Anderson takes the approach that there's no such thing as a little bit pregnant. If you're going to need chemotherapy, let's give you the best chemotherapy. And I really understand that philosophy. And I think for patients who we really feel are going to benefit from chemotherapy, I believe that TAC or Dostense or the Anderson regimen or one of the others and our own TIC-TAC trial, because those high-risk individuals are eligible. But for the patients who have more indolent disease, but they may have a T2N0 lesion, or maybe they're in the intermediate range of the recurrence score, or perhaps they're over 60 with some nodes positive, but really ER-positive disease. Personally, I do feel that there's a role for the four cycles of TC in some of those patients where the benefit from chemotherapy may be very small, somewhere between 0 to 3%, Neil. That's where I come in for the TC. But when I think there's going to be a greater benefit from chemotherapy, that's when I remind myself, I think that the anthracyclines still are the standard of care.
We've seen in our patterns of care studies actually a major shift with a lot more TC being used, a lot less AC being used in the patients with node-negative disease. I guess that doesn't surprise you.
Yes, I think that I would agree with that trend in the practice patterns. I think where we used to give four cycles of AC, I can't think of any reason to do that anymore, given Steve Jones is now very mature 7-year follow-up with a large disease-free and now overall survival advantage, and then an exploratory subset analysis in every one of the subsets, including the premenopausal, the node positive, and the ER negative, and even, well, the HER2 positive subset analysis was very, very tiny, but all of those subsets were in favor of the TC, and node positive significantly so. So I don't think that we have to ask women to incur the extra toxicity of doxorubicin, both short-term and long-term, with those TC data. So I agree completely that where we used to give 4 of AC, I think TC is the way to go now.
Now, you mentioned maybe involving the oncotype in this decision in patients with node-negative tumors. What about node-positive tumors? We saw that presentation at the last San Antonio meeting of the SWOG study. Are there any situations where you would utilize oncotype in a patient with node-positive disease?
I haven't, Neil. And I'll give you an anecdote that came up. I got a call from my partner locally here a couple of weeks ago of a woman who was 48 and had had 2 positive nodes. They weren't big, about a millimeter each, but 2 positive nodes. She had strongly ERPR positive disease, HER2 negative, grade 2, and it looked like a real ER-driven breast cancer. And so the surgeon, you know, without consulting the medical oncologist, sent an oncotype, and it came back in the low range. And so my partner was saying, gee, what do you think about this? Is this ready for prime time? Should we withhold chemotherapy? And we thought back to the data from Kathy Albain, and with tamoxifen alone, you still had 40% of patients recurring over 10 years. It wasn't clear what percentage was distant versus local regional or contralateral, but there were still 40% of recurrences. And so that's not a good prognosis group, even though her data were persuasive that the chemotherapy didn't add that much there. But of course, that was a non-taxane-based regimen. That was oral CAF, itself good chemotherapy, but without a taxane. So personally, I'm not comfortable extrapolating those data to our modern taxane-based regimens. And so my partner and I had a conversation about that patient because both of us thought she did have ER-driven disease and it wasn't very proliferative. And we were thinking, well, gee, maybe 4 of TC. But that was the example where the more we talked, the more we realized that the standard of care for node-positive, ER-positive, premenopausal women, the preponderance of data sits with anthracycline and taxane-based regimens. And We thought TAC would be a very good standard for her off trial or one of the other regimens. It looks beneficial in ER positive, like the MD Anderson regimen or AC followed by weekly Taxol or AC followed by Taxotere. I mean, there's a number of things, but we thought she'd be an ideal candidate for the TIC-TAC trial, frankly. And so that was an example where I just didn't think, even though the biology looked indolent, I didn't feel we could extrapolate from the recurrence score node positive data. So I think it's early yet, Neil, and I've not been using it. Now, having said that, I certainly do think biologically for node-positive disease. So if a woman is over 60, where we know from the Oxford overview that the benefit from chemotherapy really starts shrinking, although as we saw from HIMUS at ASCO, that if you have ER-negative disease, it doesn't make any difference how old you are. You still really benefit from combination chemotherapy. But for ER-driven, ERPR-positive, more indolent grade 2, node-positive women over the age of 60, of course, HER2-negative, there we really have to question how much benefit the women are going to get from chemotherapy. I probably wouldn't send the oncotype there, but I would very carefully assess all those parameters. One could, if one were not sure of the particular pathology laboratory that had read that woman's specimen, for example, I think the oncotype would be a very reasonable way to get a feel to make sure that it really truly was an ER-driven indolent breast cancer with a low recurrence score. I wouldn't withhold chemotherapy, but I think I would talk to the woman that there probably would not be much benefit from chemotherapy. It could be 0 to 3, 4%, and I would probably recommend 4 cycles of TC to such a woman. But if she were disinclined towards chemotherapy, I would tell her that I'm not having heartburn over that. And so I think we do think biologically, and I think there can be some times we can use the oncotype to corroborate what we think we know about the biology of a woman where we already know from the Oxford overview that her benefit from chemotherapy is going to be very modest, if any.
And I guess in terms of the oncotype, now they're reporting quantitative ER. So if they were reporting a very high quantitative ER as well as, you know, a low recurrence score, which, you know, generally goes together anyhow, I guess, is that something you'd be looking at to further support that?
Yes, and both the ER and the PR, Neil, with the low recurrence score. Again, I think that is helpful to have that real quantitative ER and PR because the dynamic range that they can get with the RT-PCR mRNA methodology on ER-PR is about 200 or more fold dynamic range, whereas when we do ER, for example, they cluster at 0 or maybe, you know, 20, 30%, 10 to 30%, and then there's a few at 50, and then there's some at 90 or 100%. And then the PR antibody is very, very unreliable. I always remember that slide that Soon Paik shows showing from the B14 and B20, so kind of a, instead of a linear relationship between amount of PR by RT-PCR and the antibody staining, it's sinusoidal. It just kind of goes up and down with no linearity at all. So the PR antibody is really not very useful. So yes, I do think that this readout of the quantitative ER-PR does help us get a little bit more information about the extent to which women are going to benefit from endocrine therapy, because I loved the data from Genomic Health two San Antonios ago, 06, where they looked at the B14, tamoxifen versus placebo, and did quantitative ER and PR by the RT-PCR and broke the ER-PR down into tertiles. And what they showed really definitively was that the degree to which you're going to benefit from tamoxifen is really dependent on your ER tertile. So the stronger your ER, the more benefit you get. Interestingly, ER was not prognostic, didn't make any difference which tertile of ER you were in terms of the overall metastagenicity and chance of recurrence of that breast cancer, but your benefit from tamoxifen was really relational to your ER. Inversely, for the PR, it was prognostic. The lower the PR, the higher the chance that the cancer already had metastatic potential. And in the placebo-treated patients, the low PR patients did considerably worse than the high PR patients. But interestingly, regardless of your PR, high, medium, or low, they got proportionately the same benefit from tamoxifen. So PR is prognostic but not predictive of tamoxifen benefit. ER is not prognostic, but it is predictive of tamoxifen benefit. So to your point, yes, the ER is really going to give us a good feel for the degree to which patients will benefit from tamoxifen, and the PR gives us a feel for the overall prognosis of that cancer.
Right from the beginning, it seemed like the issue of oncotype was immediately hooked up with the issue of being on the fence. So, you know, even when the first data came out, it was like, well, if you already know that you're going to give chemo, or if you already know that you're not going to get a chemo, well, there's no point in doing the test. And I really thought this theoretically that could apply for the node positive situation. I don't know how often this happens. But I mean, for example, getting back to your 48-year-old, if she was the kind of person who said, listen, I understand all this, I've read all this, et cetera, I really am not interested in taking chemotherapy unless I can really feel sure that it's going to benefit me. I understand that maybe I'm passing up a few percent. But if you can tell me that it's not very likely, then I'd be even with the two positive nodes. So if a patient like that said that to you, would you be more inclined to get, or would you want to see the patient be 60 before you'd want to get an Oncotype?
Kathy's data, as you know, Neil, Kathy Albane's data were in postmenopausal women. And that's important because their ovarian function is less. And so the calf, of course, in addition to some direct cytotoxicity for micrometastasis, also has an ovarian ablation suppression effect. And so I'm not sure I would ever go that way in a premenopausal woman because of the ovarian confounder situation. But if you make that scenario a definitively postmenopausal woman who's really wanting to see more evidence that she's going to get more than 2-3 points, yes, I do think so, Neil. I think that for that situation where you're really not sure and you've got a patient who really doesn't want that toxicity without more clear evidence of benefit, I think one could consider that. And I think it would end up probably already corroborating biology that you think you've got a handle on with strong ERPR, low proliferative, and HER2 negative. I think that's not unreasonable for those patients who really want all the information they can have before they make their decision.
Just another quick thing about the TIC-TAC trial. You know, it's interesting. We did an education symposium a couple weeks ago at the NSABP 50th anniversary meeting. And I think that it was the first time most of the membership had heard about the TIC-TAC and now TOE trial and was actually brought out right there at this symposium. There was a lot of interest in it. Kathy Miller was a part of that. And, of course, she's doing an adjuvant trial with an anthracycline and taxane through ECOG looking at bevacizumab. And she presented actually the safety data there, which was particularly good timing considering this new development. What's your take overall about the issue of bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting? Any particular concerns?
No, I think Kathy Miller's data are reassuring. And you know what I think, Neil, that with regard to bevacizumab or with regard to Herceptin or the combination, like on the Beth trial, that hypertension is a very, very important clinical consideration. And at least in my own practice, I've started to work with a cardiologist at Baylor who really is interested in the cardiac manifestations of these antibodies. And with afterload reduction for our patients who are hypertensive, which is a large proportion of them, with that afterload reduction, I'm finding much less problem with regard to cardiac dysfunction, particularly with Herceptin. You know, I don't monitor the heart in the same way by any means with Avastin as I do with Herceptin, although in the adjuvant setting, of course, we'll be doing careful cardiac monitoring with Avastin. And I think that with management of hypertension, I feel that we can really deal with this, you know, in terms of some lowish LVEF and, you know, just the hypertensive manifestations of Avastin. So no, Neil, I don't have concerns. Now, like anything else, we're going to have to be careful. We're going to have to screen patients for a recent history of diverticulitis. I mean, we're going to have to screen some patients because, you know, Avastin does prevent wound healing. And so we're going to have to screen our patients. We'll have to watch out for thromboembolic events for patients that are at high risk. So we're going to have to be careful about patients that we put on study. But with those safety considerations, I'm not worried about it.